Okay, welcome back. As we roll into the end of yet another week, amazing. Tomorrow, the 1st of July, the year 2005, and we have a fine program tonight, another outstanding mental exercise in taking a look at the world, the solar system, and the universe through the minds of Dave Talbot and Walt Thornhill, who are back tonight. These two men have pushed the envelope of science with the inspiration of Velikovsky, whom Dave Talbot certainly knew and worked with quite intimately for years, and they are back tonight to present something they call Deep Impact. Welcome back, David. How are you?
Hey, Jeff. Very well.
Glad
very
to have well, you. Yes. Glad to have you back again tonight. And let's see.
I'm looking forward to this one.
Oh yeah, this will be too. Let's see if Wall is down there. Are you down there in Australia, Wall?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Jeff.
Glad to have you back.
Thank you.
Have either of you gone to see Mr. Spielberg's Opus? His newest opus yet?
It just came out a couple of days ago, and I was out of town briefly, Jeff, and just returned last evening, but I am actually planning on seeing this without any expectation in any direction. So,
well, it's supposed to be entertainment. That's what Mr. Wells originally intended, of course, and
yes.
We'll see.
Yes, indeed.
It's getting apparently rave reviews.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I loved science fiction as a kid, and that was one particular movie and one particular theme that I just always wanted to follow into my adult years and just see how culturally we responded to that theme.
I've often wondered, as have many others, if Mr. Spielberg is not at such a level that he is not immune to suggestions from those folks who would seek to control much of the Western world, as it were. And the message, of course, in the motion picture industry can be profoundly moving and can stay with people for their lives. And this film is, I'm very curious to see it. And I'm wondering if there's some, I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, but if there's some reason that whatever is presented in here is being formulated and formatted in the way that we're going to see it. It's being called a horror film by some, or horrifying by some. It is also being called one of the greatest 1950s science fiction movies of all time.
Oh, now I'm really looking forward to it. 1950s, eh?
Yep.
Oh, that's great. Yes. Personally, I have really quite a respect for Spielberg, because I believe that he can be part of an entertainment group that will help to actually extend the understanding of science in ways that are necessary for breakthroughs. We call that the end run, where ideas get planted in popular imagination through innovative researchers, and official science just remains completely immune to it. But the pressure that arises culturally to give attention to these new possibilities is often underscored through means of entertainment. I believe, in terms of our own work, that this is a very likely scenario, that what will really bring an opening within science will be pressure from outside of science by people who have become impassioned by new possibilities.
This is what I was getting at. I'm not suggesting he's out stirring the public psyche with any intent, but he is well aware of the message and the reaction and the subliminal responses to imagery.
Oh, very
to,
good.
To plots. And, you know, if he weren't, he would be irresponsible, but he's not. The man is a genius at his craft, and he knows very well what he's doing.
So. Yes, we're in complete agreement on that, Jeff.
We will see. Is it down there yet, Wall?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, is it in release in Australia yet?
I think it opens today.
All right, well, very good. By the way, Wall can attest to the fact that tomorrow will arrive on schedule.
Yes.
Thank
That's
you,
right.
Wall. Thank you.
Yeah, we're first, one of the first into the new day.
So Friday is a lock, folks. You can count on it. even though it's Thursday night here in the States. All right. David, go ahead and set the stage for tonight's conversation.
Well, we have this event coming up that could have a profound impact on science. There are plenty of unknowns in this, and it won't do us any good to stick our necks out too far. But there is an excellent possibility of definitive answers coming back from the Deep Impact event. This is the probe that was sent out to Comet Tempel 1, and on July 4th, actually Pacific time, late in the evening, July 3rd, an 800-pound projectile is going to be launched from the craft into the comet and impacting it at thousands of miles per hour, of course. And official science has an expectation with respect to what will occur. There is an interpretation of cometary phenomenon called the electric comet hypothesis. Wal Thornhill is really the leading expert now on the electric comet hypothesis, following in the footsteps of the engineer Ralph Jurgens, who developed in the late 60s and the 70s a new picture of the solar environment, the sun being the center of an electric field, so that objects moving radially through this field would experience increasing stress until they began to discharge. That's what a comet is in the electric hypothesis. Conventional thought does not even entertain such ideas. And yet it is certain that if the electric hypothesis is correct, one of these days, perhaps sooner than later, we will actually encounter a comet that has no volatiles. Volatiles are the evaporating ices that are essential to the conventional model. Without them, the model collapses, and there's nothing left. Now, we can't say, because there's been no prior evidence to work with when it comes to deep impact, but there is even the possibility that impactor will penetrate to a level at which there are no volatiles at all. The nature of the surface right now is really unknown. We should see energetic events, such as an explosion of X-ray emissions and so on from the electrical activity that are simply off the map of conventional thought.
All right, Wal Thornhill, for our listeners who may not be up to speed on this, how big approximately is the head of the comet and the projectile as Dave explained, apparently we'll have no explosives. It's the velocity of it that will create the impact. Is it possible we may have a large explosion? What are you expecting?
Well, I'm expecting electrical activity as the copper projectile approaches the comet nucleus. The traditional model expects that there will be an explosion due to just the impact energy, considering that the comet's approaching the projectile at about 23,000 miles an hour. So the comet nucleus itself, I believe, has been compared with half the size of Manhattan. So it's a reasonable size.
Oh, it is. It's bigger than I thought. I didn't know it was that large.
I think it's 9 kilometers long.
Wow.
Uh-huh. It is a lot longer than it is wide, so to speak.
Yes. And how are we going to effectively observe this? Are we going to have direct NASA transmissions of this from deep space? Will it be observed with the Hubble? Just for our listeners, let's give them a good, solid understanding of what's happening.
I believe there is a camera in the projectile itself, so that it will be looking at the comet as it approaches.
Wow.
Also, the spacecraft that's carried the projectile, after it separates from the projectile, will continue to look in with a high-resolution instrument at the comet nucleus to see what happens.
And is this going to be a direct feed that we can monitor from here, or will NASA, as unfortunately has been the case for quite some time now, will they capture all the video and then release it to us at their at their own pace.
We've seen way too much of that, and I'm afraid that's what's going on. I was looking for some evidence that there would be an internet feed. Now, and I'm not discounting that possibility. I know that the visitor center at the Kitt Peak National Observatory, Wal, do you know where that is? I just happened to pick this off the internet.
I see.
The visitor center at Kitt Peak National Observatory plans to offer a live feed of the encounter between NASA's Deep Impact mission and Comet Tempel 1. And that begins a half an hour before the actual impact on the nucleus. But I could not find any indication in the official Deep Impact websites saying anything about live internet coverage, and we should continue to look for that.
All right, we will, and we'll pause and come right back with David Talbot and Wal Thornhill in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back. Talking with scientific researchers David Talbot and Wal Thornhill, two of the men at the top of an incredibly exciting discipline in science, the electric universe. And we're talking about the upcoming Deep Impact event of July 3rd and 4th. We're going to look into this and see if there is a live feed. Hopefully Kitt Peak will come through like you suggest. But Wal, go ahead and tell us more about this projectile slamming into this rather light. Now, 900 pounds into 9 kilometers at 22,000 miles an hour. I don't have my calculator, nor would it help me, but the the mathematics of impact at that velocity, you know, are probably pretty formidable. But tell us, Wal, how you view it. And again, you do both expect an electrical observance or a measurable electrical result prior to the physical impact. So tell me more, Wal.
Yeah, before I do that, Jeff, if people want to see up-to-date information about the Tempel 1 and Deep Impact, they could do no better than to go to the Planetary Society. Just do a Google search on the Planetary Society.
Right.
They have an animation of images taken from the Deep Impact spacecraft as it's homing in on the target, and they usually have news items which they produce themselves, which are bang up to date, and often include information which is offhand from researchers.
So okay, this is planetarysociety.com, perhaps?
No, it's www.planetary.org.
Okay, just simply planetary.org.
Yeah, and if you find the news there.
I'll second that. They have been one of the most continually interesting sites for up-to-date perspectives and so on. They of course work very closely with and get a lot of cooperation from the NASA investigators directly. But they tend to be more current often than a lot of the other more official sites.
I'll put it up in a featured story within minutes at the top of Rents.com, and we'll follow it.
Super.
Okay. Yeah, getting back to the impact energy, it's been calculated to be equivalent to 4.5 tons of TNT exploding.
Okay, that's quite a bit. That's 10,000 pounds.
And yet, in terms of the higher levels of energetic, it might be that would be dwarfed by the power of the electrical force. Am I correct?
Yes, it's interesting that Comet Tempel 1 flared up just a few days ago, and that
very mysterious.
That is actually not understood by astronomers, but it is understood electrically as just an electrical flaring event, and that augurs well for us seeing electrical phenomena as we close in on the nucleus of the comet.
What kind of electrical phenomena would you expect and hope to see, Wall? I know measurable. Are we talking also visual?
Yes. In fact, there's more than a dozen telescopes, both in space and on Earth, focused on this event. So hopefully we will get information coming in over the following days from a number of sources.
And that does include the Hubble telescope. So we'll get some pretty stunning views, I would imagine.
Yeah, one of the things that I would expect would be a jet directed precisely at the projectile before it reaches the nucleus. And that could partially vaporize the incoming copper projectile, which means we would begin to see copper atoms in the spectra from the cameras looking at the event.
What about the immobilization of that camera, which has promised such an exciting view as it approaches, up to what, a few 10,000
kilometers? I think the idea is that dust and material coming from the comet will cause the lenses and that on the camera on the projectile to be fogged, and that nothing useful will be gained down in the last few tens of kilometers.
Tens of kilometers. Now, the spacecraft, am I correct, is to the fore of the trajectory. It's sort of coming head-on toward the comet, correct?
Well, I think the comet's speed is such that whatever the spacecraft is doing is inconsequential. It's
right.
Almost standing still.
But I mean,
the
tangent of intercept is what? The spacecraft would be where... vis-a-vis the trajectory of the comet?
I seem to recall that it would be about 500 kilometers away at the time of impact.
Directly in front, David Talbot, or to the side?
Well,
do we know?
The projectile is, in effect, going to be on a head-on course, primarily because of the speed and trajectory of the comet.
Uh-huh.
The spacecraft is, for protective purposes, off to the side a bit,
okay,
and then it will be rotated in order to shield. They have a shield on it to protect it from the debris they expect to kick up into space.
So what kind of interference would precede the comet for tens of kilometers, which could occlude the lenses of the cameras set to record this?
One of the things that can happen is that it can encounter one of these jets from the comet nucleus, which, as it was found on the close approach to comet Vilt 2 or Wild 2, there are these very highly concentrated jets of matter coming from the comet nucleus.
Pulsing.
If it was to strike one of those, it could actually damage the lens surface so that you would only get a blurred image.
All right, well, let's think positively. We've got apparently two cameras, one on the actual projectile and one on the spacecraft.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, the spacecraft one should be okay, I think, because they're 500 kilometers away.
How 30 seconds, how far away from Earth is this event happening, David?
I think it's about 100 and, let's see now, it's about at the orbit of Mars, actually.
Okay.
And that's a very significant point, too, in terms of the dynamics of comets, and maybe we can take that up.
We will, when we continue in just a couple minutes with Wall Thornhill and Dave Talbot. Jeff Rentz with Dave Talbot and Wall Thornhill, who is down in Australia. All right, Deep Impact coming up soon. The animation is up there. The Planetary Society has it. It's a NASA animation. This is going to occur Sunday, July the 3rd, and in the vicinity of Mars. Dave, what intrigues you about that?
Well, it's at the orbit of Mars, and Mars won't be there, but I guess this would be roughly 150 million miles from
the
Sun.
Okay, but at the same distance from Earth, or the Sun, rather, that Mars usually
orbits. Mars' orbit. Mm-hmm. When Mars is circling the Sun, it's circling in an orbit roughly at that distance. So the comet is sort of moving between the distances of Jupiter and Mars from the Sun. It's not coming into our system from deeper space. Science doesn't care. Official science does not care about how far out it may go in its orbit, because it is not thinking in electrical terms. So it did not look for a comet that would be moving on a more elliptical orbit. In the electrical hypothesis, a comet on a less elliptical orbit like Tempel is a less dynamic object, because it is not spending a large portion of its time out in a more removed region, adjusting to the negative charge in that region of the electric field. When a comet comes in from a larger distance, it is bringing a larger charge, a greater charge, into the positively charged region of the Sun. So the differential is a force working for major electrical activity. So when Hale-Bopp came through, we saw vastly more energetic levels of activity than we'll see on Tempel. Now, science, as it views comets today, it can't make any such distinction. If it's at that distance from the Sun, it's going to be receiving a certain level of heat, and who cares where it was previously? Now, this raises questions as to what is going on with Tempel right now. Why is an object at the distance of the Sun from Mars discharging this way? Mars has water on it. It doesn't discharge. We see comets discharging out at the distance of the Sun of Jupiter, even farther than that.
When you say discharging, be more specific.
It's ejecting material. Material is being ejected. Gases, plasma, and so on.
Outgassing,
ion tails, and so on.
Violently outgassing in streams and jets.
Yes, jets of material at great energies and velocities. That will make no sense in terms of the concept of a sublimating snowball.
Okay.
And this can be explored experimentally.
Uh-huh.
I mean, science needs to be challenged to duplicate what we observe, because wherever we observe ice at those distances, we don't see these effects. We're seeing the effect right now on Tempel, which is not up to the level of the more dramatic cometary displays, but it is occurring, and there was a completely mysterious outburst of dust just days ago.
Now let me switch to Wall Thornhill on this. If there, and you know, the average person might think, well, it's out there and it's some kind of friction or that's causing it to heat up and off gas, outgas. But that's of course not the case in deep space. So Wall, give us you and David's concept of what is going on to cause these outgassings of an alleged snowball, or at least what we used to think of as just a snowball.
You know, I think the advantage we have with the electrical model is that it gives a very simple and coherent explanation for all of the strange features that have been seen in close-up pictures of comets, and also their behavior. And basically what's happening is that in the electrical model of the solar system, the Sun is an anode, or positively charged body, which attracts electric current from the surrounding galaxy, and that produces the light and the heat and all of the strange behavior we witness there.
Mm-hmm.
A comet, on the other hand, is less positively charged. All these things are relative in the electric universe, which means that far out from the Sun, where the sun's electric field, which is constant over throughout the planetary system, it will cause the comet to charge to a certain level consistent with its position in the solar system or distance from the sun.
All right.
Now, as it moves towards the sun, it does this very slowly at first, but at the end of the approach to the sun, it's racing at breakneck speed towards the sun, and it's entering regions where the charge density and the voltage, if you like, is considerably different.
Hmm.
And it gets to the point, finally, where it becomes what's known in the electrical jargon as a cold cathode. And a cold cathode can emit electrons and also strip material from its surface in a very strong electric field. And this is precisely what we see happening to a comet. So the jets and the coma and all of the X-rays and the strange things that have been witnessed associated with comets can be explained very simply in this model. And, of course, the funny thing is that at the end of the 19th century, the scientific journals like Nature and others were quite happy to publish papers on the electrical nature of comets. It's only in since then that this dogma of icy snowballs has arisen.
How did the snowball usurp what was known in the 19th century to be a pretty nuts and bolts kind of approach to this issue? Are we suspicious here? What happened?
Yes, we are suspicious. I think it came about because astronomers managed to convince themselves, and not just astronomers, but astrophysicists and geophysicists, that all bodies in the universe must be effectively at the same potential. Because plasma is a good conductor, and therefore you cannot sustain charge separation. And this is the crux of the matter when it comes to accepting an electric universe or a gravitational universe. Because once you allow for charge separation on cosmological scales, then everything we witness can be explained in terms of charge recombination. And it is quite amazing, really, that we can consider that the universe is driven by the weakest force known, while in our everyday life we use electricity to drive electric motors, to heat and light our homes, and so on.
And create X-rays.
Quite incredible.
So when we come back, let's ask Dave to elaborate on comets. Are they all pretty much headed toward this model we're discussing, or are they... they are. So the snowball issue is melting rapidly.
Very good, Jeff.
All right. Well, hold on. We'll come back and follow up on this. This is most interesting. I remember Hale Bopp and all the terrible melodrama that went along with that. And that comet was at its closest, I think, 23 million miles away, wasn't it, David? That was a long way away. It was a big comet. All right. Back in just a minute with Wall and Dave. We're back with Dave Talbot and Wall Thornhill talking about our deep impact event. So the snow cone idea is melting. And, I mean, do we retire it permanently? Are you guys ready to just erase the blackboard in terms of that one? Or do we have room out there for both kinds?
Well, I think actually there isn't much room for both, because the electrical hypothesis is maintaining that a comet is an electrical or plasma discharge phenomenon, and it is that simple. And there is such a big picture at stake here. Now, people generally just will not realize this, Jeff. They will not realize that we just may be on the verge right now of a cataclysmic event in the sciences, because if the dirty snowball theory crashes, there is a whole range of science that crashes with it. Because the dirty snowball theory arose from the necessity of finding an explanation for comets within an electrically neutral universe.
I got it.
And if that theory collapses, only the electrical comet theory of the 19th century and so on is left, and that requires an electric field of the sun. Out goes the whole cosmology of the sun and stars and galaxies. The whole starting point of the sciences, the queen of the sciences, cosmology, would not have a leg to stand on if they have ignored electricity for decades. And we have just seen that we are in an electrically active universe. See, science in its specialization fragmented not just science, but its picture of the universe. All of a sudden, we were living in this huge and vast space with separate islands, all completely disconnected from each other. Everything that we observed had to be explained by what was going on inside things we observed. The electric universe is saying that isn't the nature of our world, or of space, of objects in space, of the larger universe at all. Everything is connected, and a comet is a part of that circuitry. A comet underscores the electrical nature of our solar system because it is moving radially through the electric field of the sun. It's not staying at the same distance from the sun.
Right.
So a comet could expose in the most dramatic way the failure of modern cosmology. And
but,
the picture's completely changed then.
All right, but it is an asteroid, is it not, in motion? It is a piece of...
Maybe I should pick up on what Dave said. There is one other model out there which should be mentioned, and that's Tom Van Flanden's exploding planet model, where comets and asteroids are essentially the same thing, and they're both rocky with some volatiles, maybe. But Tom uses an exploding planet, which he felt used to exist in the solar system. And then for some reason, which is not well explained, it exploded. Now, there's a very strong similarity there to the electrical model, because comets and asteroids in the electrical model are formed by the electrical machining of larger bodies like planets during close approaches, when during periods of instability in a planetary system, because we know gravitational systems of planets are inherently unstable. So something has to happen when they do become unstable.
All right.
And comets and asteroids are formed at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this paints a completely different picture to the one we're taught about how the solar system formed slowly from a collapsing cloud of dust and gas, and that comets are merely the leftovers. And those leftovers are conveniently placed in the Oort cloud, which is supposed to be at about a light year from the sun. Now, Tom Van Flanden has very effectively demolished that idea and pointed out that this is another example where astronomers resort to invisible objects to explain or to patch their stories together. And I would agree with him.
Okay.
Very good.
I understand, yeah. Okay. Next up.
So,
all right, well, we've talked about the outgassing. We've talked about the occlusion of the lenses, potentially. We've laid this thing out pretty clearly. Now, let's assume that asteroids and comets begin as the same kind of rocky pieces, debris, whatever. If they're
debris cast
fine.
Into space in the violent history of our solar system.
Correct. Right. Now, they don't all act the same way, though. Now, is it because some asteroids don't have any volatile material and others do, that if they are both flung, the one with the volatiles will begin to take on the appearance more of a comet rather than just a large piece of moving rock? Or
yes.
Is this, have I missed something along the way?
No, that's actually happened. There's one body in the outer solar system called Chiron, which developed a coma. It was classified as an asteroid and then developed a coma, which would make it a comet.
So it was on an elliptical orbit, Wall?
It was on a somewhat elliptical orbit, but as we know from comet behavior, the sun's activity is also involved in outbursts in the outer solar system.
Oh, sure.
So this has been observed, actually, with Comet Halley, which had an outburst out beyond Saturn, following an outburst on the sun. So this shows that it is all connected. The business about whether these are electrical or not, I think, was shown by a comet Shoemaker-Levy 9.
What did we learn from Shoemaker-Levy 9?
Well, we saw there the kinds of things that I would expect from an electrical point of view, but which were described conventionally, with ad hoc ideas tossed in. For instance, comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 broke up. It gives the idea that comets are made up of just sandbanks almost, they just fall apart. But in the electrical model, if a body is discharging strongly, then it can explode like a capacitor that's been over-voltaged. The insulation breaks down and the thing actually explodes. And this is the kind of thing that comets seem to do inexplicably. They'll suddenly explode into a number of pieces. Now, these pieces, when they arrived at Jupiter, gave a display which was totally unexpected on Earth. There were huge outbursts of radiation which overloaded some of the observing telescopes on Earth. And, of course, that was explained away as being the energy of the impact with the upper atmosphere. But if you recall, after the dust had settled, so to speak, we saw dark rings on Jupiter.
Right, I do remember that, yeah.
You know, those dark rings are characteristic of the volcanoes on Io, the so-called volcanoes. And I think we may have talked about these earlier.
Jupiter's closest moon.
Jupiter's closest moon, that's right,
mm-hmm.
Which is supposed to be the most active volcanic body in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back in shortly after the discovery of these so-called volcanoes, Professor Tommy Gold made the observation that they could equally be explained as electric discharges. And then later, Tony Perrett and A.J. Dessler published a paper showing that the fallout pattern for an electric discharge on Io would produce that characteristic ring and also the shape of the ejector as it rose into space. So they more or less showed that the things happening on Io are electric discharges. Now, if we apply that same model to Jupiter, what occurred on Jupiter was what I would expect as this copper projectile approaches Comet Tempel 1,
mm-hmm.
And that is that there will be a discharge which forms a jet, which then has a fallout which produces these circular patterns. So it happened to Jupiter, it happens on Io. It's the same kind of thing that produces the jets on comets.
One thing we might mention about Shoemaker-Levy is that they were expecting to find great volumes of water, and they could not find any water spectroscopically in Shoemaker-Levy. And this has been now a pattern. The missing water, or the so-called depletion of water, has had astronomers and cometologists scratching their heads. The surface of Comet Borelli was bone dry. So it seems virtually certain to us whether or not we find a bone dry Comet Tempel 1. It seems certain that one of these days we will run into a comet actively discharging, which has no volatiles whatsoever. And it may be that when the copper projectile, if it's able to reach the surface and penetrates deep within the surface, that it just hits a rock. This is always going to be, when we approach a comet, a possibility.
Mm. We should also be clear that comets are formed from different bodies, and we know that some of the moons in the outer solar system have a considerable amount of ice on their surfaces. So comets would be expected to have the same kinds of compositions as the rocks and ices of those moons. So it's not surprising that some comets do have volatile. But they'd be more likely to be on the surfaces of the comet and not in the interior. So the expectation that the projectile might go straight through the comet, because it's almost not there, is not something that I would expect to happen.
If Mars's moon Phobos were put on an elliptical orbit, let's just say between the distance of the Earth from the Sun and the distance of Jupiter, right, it would be a comet. It's that simple, electrically. But conventionally, there would be no explanation.
Okay, all right. Stand by. We'll take a break. Come right back with Dave Talbot and Wal Thornhill. Deep Impact coming up in 3 days. Stand by.